pre-colonial understandings of African societies have always accepted and understood queerness in a way that doesn't sit in resistance to anything, then for us to be able to reconceptualize that for ourselves as well, we need to go, not necessarily go back to those times, but go back to an understanding of those existences that also doesn't sit in resistance to anything and just exists on its own.
Podcast Burkhultov Center for Literature.
Welcome to Queer Circles, the podcast series which aims to break through Western narrative of queerness and shed light of queer histories and cultural practices from Nigeria and beyond. Queer Circles is a collaboration between Obodo, a Nigerian youth-led LGBTQ organization, and Bund Usof, Center for Literature in Germany. The project seeks to make different expressions of queerness visible and explore the intersection of queer activism with literature, art, film, and science. I am your host, Matthew Blaze, and I am here today with Adebayo Quadri Adekombi and Kayode Ani, and we'll be discussing queering art and literature in Nigeria. Thank you so much for joining me, Adebayo and Kayode. Adebayo, please, could you introduce yourself and also your work?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. My name is Adebayo Quadri Adekombi, and I am a PhD candidate. I'm researching the intersectional politics of queer activism and feminism in Nigeria. So, looking into how queer people are mobilizing despite being criminalized by the state. And yeah, I'm here to contribute to the pandemic of Black people with podcast mics.
Thank you so much for your contribution. So, moving to you, Kayode, could you tell us about yourself and also your work and your book, which is coming out soon?
Hi, everyone. So my name is Anikayode Somtochku. I am a writer, a scientist, and a queer liberation activist. I am the Central Committee Chair of the Queer Union for Economic and Social Transformation. And my work as a writer centers or focuses on queer visibility, queer resistance, queer identity, particularly, you know, in a colonial kind of narrative where queerness is conceptualized as Western and imported. And I have a novel coming out in June, July.
I'm so excited about that novel. Yeah, same. Yeah, tell us more about that novel.
Yeah, so it's a story about two women in University of Nigeria and Soka, who kind of, you know, come from wildly different backgrounds. And the novel kind of explores, you know, the way that we experience states repression as well as societal subjugation very differently, depending on, you know, what class backgrounds we come from, our gender expression, the way we actually kind of project ourselves politically. Right. The name of the novel, by the way, I can't believe I've not mentioned this. The name of the novel is And Then He Sang a Lullaby. Mm. So it's coming out.
Shield title.
It's really nice.
It's coming out in June in the US and UK and in Nigeria from Cassava Republic in July.
Adebayo, you are with a quote, your favorite. Is it your favorite?
It's let's not do that. It's not my favorite, but yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
I reason with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's from a book called She Called Me Woman. Also published by Cassava Republic, actually, which is publishing. No, Cassava Republic has range. Bibi Bakare Yusuf. Oh, my goodness. Love her. No, I do. It's in the book She Called Me Woman, which is just kind of this amazing queer literature that delves into the lived experiences of queer women in Nigeria. And this is from chapter 3 called Love Is Not Wrong. And it says, I quote, "I know 14 years stands out, but even before the act came out, it wasn't any different. Nothing has changed for me because whatever I was doing before, I'm still doing now. They have just brought it into the limelight. I guess the effect of the law is that people need to hide more, but I was already hiding. The law has made me a little bit more careful, but that is about all. I guess it would have more of an effect on people with a different lifestyle."
I really find that quote very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested in how this quote connects with your own idea of queerness in this context.
Yeah, I think just to, I guess, clarify, the law that's being spoken about here is the SSMPA specifically. And I think...
For those who don't know, the SSMPA is the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act that was passed into law in 2014 by the then president, Goodluck Ebele Jonathan. And it criminalizes public display of affection for same-sex relationships, people, bans gay clubs, organizing, and also gay marriages, bans gay marriages, and puts a 14 years imprisonment punishment to it. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's very important because it really does highlight how the law is a boundary in regards to how we exist, but also how much the law is also low-key inconsequential because we're so deeply rooted in so much homophobia, both internalized and from the outside world as well. And in regards to how that affects my understanding of queerness, I think I've always seen queerness as a non-identitarian, non-normative understanding of living. So it's not, for me, it's not synonymous to LGBTQ+. It's a specific political positioning. I mean, more recently, I have been delving into understanding queerness that does not seek to resist anything. Mm. So queerness that doesn't start from a place of resistance, that doesn't start from a place of anti-normativity. But that's not like fully cooked yet.
Speaking about criminalization and also colonialism, Kayode, your work and your recent book focuses on that. Your work generally, how does it capture this subject? How do you reflect them?
I think for me, I kind of approach queerness as a form of, I guess in opposition to what he is exploring at this point, kind of, starting from a position of resistance, just because queerness, particularly, the way it exists today is marginalized, right? And that marginalization isn't something that is abstract or something that you could decide to opt out of or something that you could decide to, I don't want to kind of conceptualize myself within this marginalization, because the way our society is structured, where people are on the margins, and that marginalization is in relation to non-queer people who are centered in society as the default. So that's kind of my own perspective on it. And in even, going back to the quote that he read out, it's kind of also, says a lot, because a lot of these laws are repetitions of things we already have on the books, right? And the reason they are being passed or the reason they are being, drummed up is because they create a sort of a political atmosphere that the ruling class needs, particularly at this point, or particularly at whenever time they decide to. Because if you go back and you look at the times that homophobic laws are kind of ratcheted out in the African context is always in times of serious economic downturns and serious levels of unpopularity for whichever government is in power. So when they actually kind of bring up these laws, it's precisely because they need it as a way of kind of creating a plane of adhesion between them and the rest of like cis heteronormative society, like straight, cisgender and heterosexual people. So they need to give them something to kind of signal to them that, hey, I'm still, this is your government. We are protecting you from this. We are protecting society from this, right? A lot of people will be like, I'm not queerphobic or I'm not homophobic because I don't fear gay people, but it's not even about fearing gay people or fearing queer people. It's about fearing queerness, which is a very real fear. People fear it in their, it's plaguing their children or finding its way into their homes, or, you know, and this fear is so severe that it even pushes people to preemptive violence, right? So that's kind of like the way I approach wellness. I approach it as, you know, something that is very politicized, something that is, you know, unable to be unpoliticized, at least while we are living in a society where people continue to be the scapegoats of neoliberal, you know, neoliberalist expansion on the continent. So
And also, your work focuses on decolonization. How do you approach that?
Yeah, so because a lot of the political work I do is also not just with queer organizations, but also organizations that are engaged in socialist and national liberation struggles, I have, you know, been on a journey of conceptualizing queerness as a form of decolonization, because the ways in which criminalization and marginalization and exclusivity affect queer people in, on the African continent is always directly traceable back to, you know, colonization on this continent. And this is regardless of if you come from a traditional community that accepted queer people, that loaded queer people, that were indifferent to queer people, that worshipped queer people. Regardless of that, I know that if that community is in Africa before colonization, it did not have a lot of the mechanisms for, you know, marginalizing queer people, such as prisons, such as the police, such as, you know, laws of incarceration, the media and the churches, and the way in which queer people are ordered, because our societies don't really order people the way Western societies do, even when these people are people that are considered, you know, outside the social norm. There's not this level of, oh, this person is so different from the whole rest of us, right? It's more of this person that is one of us is doing this thing that the rest of us don't do. So there's also that. And that's why I think that we should, as queer activists, really approach queer liberation struggle from a point of decolonization, from a point of taking back our continent, from a point of ending, you know, the neocolonial kind of subjugation that we are currently under from the West. Because a lot of the times it's as if people think that, you know, queerness in Africa is because of the West, right?
Yeah.
Whereas it is queerphobia,
homophobia,
that is because of the West.
I mean, so it's funding like queerphobic bills in Uganda, in Kenya,
to the tune of millions of dollars. Imagine people in fucking America sending millions and millions of US dollars in Africa to push laws that will put African queer people in prison and have them killed and have them excluded from African society. Like, how are you even in our business right now? Like, who invited you? So that's kind of like how I approach it.
Thank you so much, Kayode. And moving on to you, Adebayo, your work also is around decolonization and critiquing the West.
I call it dragging.
So how do you approach this whole subject of queerness from that point?
I think it's very difficult. It's not the easiest thing to do, and I think that's because queerness is still being formed. It's dynamic, right? And it's still being formed and understood for us in Africans as Africans, and I think that's where the whole notion about even how do we understand our queerness in Africa from a point that doesn't start from a point of resistance. That's where that's kind of coming from as well, because I think oftentimes if we can understand that pre-colonial understandings of queerness have always afforded, pre-colonial understandings of African societies have always accepted and understood queerness in a way that doesn't sit in resistance to anything, then for us to be able to reconceptualize that for ourselves as well, we need to go won't necessarily go back to those times, but go back to an understanding of those existences that also doesn't sit in resistance to anything and just exists on its own. And I think that's what's always really difficult, because for a lot of that, you then have to reorient yourself outside of Western thought. Mm. And it's not to say Western thought is not useful. You know, there are definitely some useful like theories. A lot of these theories of queerness and queer theory and all of that stuff have been cultivated by Western thinkers. They've contributed to it, not like, because Africans are also conceptualizing these for ourselves as well. But it's about recentering what I like to understand. This is something Oyoro Koyo, when he talks about recentering African paradigms and decentering the West from it. And I think, again, even in that, in doing that, we can understand how we can understand ourselves for who we are, as opposed to understanding ourselves in relation and in resistance to the West. Because I think what tends to happen is when we're trying to define ourselves, or it's not about who we are, but it's about who the West is and what we are not, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's high time we start shifting that, as opposed to saying, okay, this is what the West is and what we are not. It's about who we are. And it's like, we don't care what the West is and how they are.
That is very powerful and also interesting. I want to know, when it comes to queer storytelling in Africa, in Nigeria generally, do you think it's also being cultivated?
Is what being cultivated?
Queer storytelling, queer art.
I think very similarly, again, to an understanding of queerness, I think it applies here as well, in the sense that it's still being cultivated. So it's in that process. I think what you have is, unfortunately, the deeply entrenched queer phobia that we tend to have means that a lot of queer stories are being very much put under the radar in regards to the attention they get. So it's not like they don't exist, mm-hmm. right? It's just that a lot of us don't always know about them. So a lot of queer literature that even I'm only just discovering, and they've been around for a long time, and a lot of them just don't necessarily get the same popularity that a lot of the more, I guess, heteronormative stories get. And I think that's kind of what the issue is. But again, I think even going back to the understanding of what are queer stories, you know, I think it goes beyond just them being LGBT, right? There are, and I think that's why someone like Kayode's work is really important in regards to the interrogation of queerness, not as a sexual orientation, but an interrogation of queerness as a political, analysis, right? So it goes into class, it goes into gender identity, it goes into some of these different things, which is why I like your description of your story. I think is quite apt in this moment, you know, because it's something that incorporates a lot of these understandings of queerness that are moving beyond just, oh, it's only queer because it's two gay people.
Yeah, same sex.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kayode, what do you define as queer storytelling? What are queer stories to you?
I would say a queer story is a story that explores the queer experience. That would, because I feel like if you get more specific than that, you are definitely going to exclude some queer stories. So it's something that is hard to define. Particularly because, I mean, I've even read stories of protagonists that, you know, in these stories aren't queer, but have some sort of relationship that kind of challenges the heteronormative expectations of what friendship between, you know, people of the same gender should be, particularly men. Mm. So it's, I would just leave it as stories that explore the queer experience, because I wouldn't want to, you know, kind of exclude any queer story from my, in my definition. I do think that, you know, going towards Adebayo was saying, there is also kind of a big push to make queer stories more accessible. It's basically like, I would define it as a significant effort to nurture queer literature on the continent. We are, you know, talking about a lot of prizes that, you know, make space and include queer writers, talking of magazines that include queer writers, magazines even that are just for queer Africans and Afro-descendant people, like just them. If you're not queer, don't even submit.
Get out.
And I think it's so important, because what part of the reasons why queer literature on the continent has been so kind of subsumed is because the homophobia and the queerphobia that exists on the continent actually shapes what people enjoy. Mm-hmm. And because of that, queer literature isn't commercially viable on the continent, right? Even it's a situation where if you write a queer novel about Nigeria and you're living in Nigeria or any other African country, you have better luck securing the Nigerian publisher for it after you've secured the major publisher abroad. So it's a whole thing. I remember my novel, I started with Nigerian publishers.
Let's not get into that.
The way I was aired, okay, everybody I think I submitted to like, say, three or so.
Three Nigerian publishers?
Yes. And the other two just completely aired me.
Oops.
And one actually told me, yeah, they can't publish this at this time. You know, the normal, it's not your story. We wish you luck as you keep writing. Please think of us when you submit.
Wait, they said it's not theirs to publish or what?
They said they decided to not move on with this manuscript at this time. That is not that the manuscript is bad, it's just that they have limited number of slots that they publish, blah blah blah.
Okay.
And now so it's a situation where it's, you know, it's also a commercial consideration, because the writing industry is also very much about like, can we market the fuck out of this book? Can we make money from this? So there's also that. And a lot of the time, even when some of these queer stories would be very commercially successful, because of homophobia, because of queerphobia, the people at the helm of industry, the publishers, the agents, just don't believe it would be. And so you are stopped even before you get to the people, you are already stopped.
And also,
by.
I think about censorship too from the government and different, like, people are so scared of.
And safety too, because you wouldn't want to be that publisher that published someone and then the person was killed for publishing that. There's also
different concerns.
There are different concerns.
But then there's homophobia and transphobia.
And this is something that, like, someone was talking to me about, actually, about how different privileges warrant different needs of safety. Shout out to you, Delacour. Like, and it's so, like, when she said that, it really blew my mind, because it goes back to what you're saying, in a sense that some people can absolutely afford to be visible in certain ways and some people just absolutely can't, right? So it's like, for a lot of these publishers and a lot of people, and I think that's why I've been more recently grappling with the ambivalence of all of our existences in this spaces, because for some people it's not because they don't want to do anything, right? But a lot of them are just scared. Some it's fear for you, but some it's also fear for themselves, because it's like, I'm also now putting a target on my back when I do this, but I'm also putting a target on your back. And I think it's that complication also that allows me to afford some degree of grace to, like, conversations about this, particularly in artistic spaces, because for a lot of these people, it's like, they have to navigate that. Some people, it's a lie. Don't listen to them. They're actually just homophobic. But like, for a good portion of people, it's not because they are. And you can always tell with the nuances of, you know, how they go about navigating it. And even this idea of, like, them having to water down your story to fit in certain ways, it's like, sometimes it's not because they even want to or feel they need to. It's just because for them it's like, look, I don't want this drama for either of us. And it's like, again, with different spaces, and for example with your one, what you mentioned about, like, after international seal of approval, because that again buys you another degree of privilege that allows a different degree of safety, because the fact that it's, at least it's an international book, you know, them also now co-signing it, they can go back to say, oh no, it's just because the do you get what I mean? And it's like, I think even that in itself speaks to this ambivalence is that like no one's ever actually doing the right.
But it's also thing a very entirely. It's also a very kind of tricky and I would say dangerous thing, right? Because a lot of these international publishers, just by force of habits, always offer world rights. They offer to buy world rights, so they want the rights to your book all over the world. And what that means is your book is going to cost like $30 or $25 in Nigeria. Who's gonna buy that, right? Because you don't have a Nigerian publisher. And even some people, like I was lucky because Roxane is my publisher, so when I like put my foot down and was like, I want, you know, the rights to Africa, because as well they also offered me the, to, you know, to buy world rights to my book. And when I asked for the rights to Africa, there was zero pushback. They didn't try to kind of like, this is what everybody normally offers, kind of, you get. And a lot of the times when that happens, number one, your book gets sanitized in the West. Nigerians can't even recognize what they're reading, the people that are talking, even though these are, this is a Nigerian story. And at the same time, the book is also very, very inaccessible in that particular country, because, you know, it doesn't have a Nigerian publisher. So it's also, it's very, very kind of, because what you now creates is, the, it creates a situation where all the, a lot of the queer stories, even those that are by us, are published by them, right?
Yeah.
Not by any.
And it's not available to us.
And it's not even available.
And then it begs the question, who is the story for?
So we beg, exactly.
Right. Who is the story for? Who are you telling this story?
It leads me to my next question at the bio. When we tell stories, especially queer stories, I fear that these days there's always this old Western queer narrative that we try to tell, like stories of two people of the same sex falling in love and they want marriage. They just want to get married, wear this white, normal English wedding, right? So, I don't know. Do you have anything to say to that when it comes to Westernization of African queer stories? Are we falling into that? Are we falling into that hole? That we should definitely avoid.
Yeah, I think it's something that Kaede has even just spoken to as well, like, because kind of the West has hegemonic control over these knowledges and how they are published, how they are said, how they are told. And so inevitably, whatever stories you tell that the West will buy from you and want to publish in the West for the Western audience will be stories that the Western audience can recognize. And again, it's inevitable that that will be the case. And it goes back to whenever you read a lot of these African books published by African authors and all of that stuff within Africa, they read very differently, which goes back to who is the story for, right? And that is what unfortunately tends to reflect whenever we do have a few queer stories that center on, you know, marriage and all of these very
westernized
ideas of queer liberation, because again, that is what the West recognizes. And like, I think it's also important that we understand that this is not even just limited to queerness. Like,
yeah, I want
even
exactly.
Yeah, like you see a lot of other stories that we tell, they all tend to very much appeal to the Western bourgeoisie. Like, it's like, even look at Nollywood movies, right? And look how the quote unquote rich Nigerians act in them. It's like, this is not an episode of Dynasty. Like, what are you doing? Like, no one talks like that. Do you know? Like, nobody talks
but
like this.
I have some views on this, because I think it's actually worse than just it being about media curation. I think it's a situation where neoliberalization has devastated our culture. American cultural imperialism has eaten so deep that if you actually go out and go to the house of these rich people, this is actually how they be talking, right? If you actually talk to a lot of queer people, these are their desires, right? They actually do want to get married and have that white picket fence and two kids and, you know, 2.5 kids and a dog, right? That is the way that they conceptualize freedom and, you know, happiness, right? And which
you are
why
to deconstruct it.
Which is why
what makes you happy doesn't actually make you happy, guys.
Which is why I also think that, you know, queer literature as a form of critique against this kind of narratives of how we even define freedom, right? Mm. Is freedom actually really you being able to get married, or is it marriage losing the kind of cultural, political, and financial significance that it has, so that everybody can have, you know, happiness without having to get married, right? Is it you traveling abroad, which is a personal win? Is that freedom, or is freedom the ability to live free in your own homeland without having to cut off connection to your own people, to your own culture, to your own heritage? So I think that that's a role, a key role that queer literature is trying to kind of delve into now. And I think that, I don't know, it's...
No, I get that. And
I love this insight because it's not what a lot of people are talking about.
Yeah.
It's just these love stories and then they get married at some point, which is valid. I mean, people have like these dreams that they want to... attain, right? And it's very valid. You want white wedding, good for you. You want different kind of weddings, good for you, right? But let's not see that as the
yardstick. And I think that's it. Even speaks to like this whole thing about what tends to happen again when the West kind of takes over from these stories, and how they, and when I say the West, I don't mean just literally the West geographically, but West like psychologically, because like a lot of us, even in Nigeria, we are Western in regards to how we think, how we act. And I, again, going back to what Kaede mentioned, like these are the desires of some people. This is how they speak sometimes. And I think it goes back to the, what tends to happen as well, even with queer literature, queer arts, is like the queer community tends to be seen as a community, and that tends to happen with a lot of marginalized groups, you know, Africans, Blacks, Black people, queer people,
the global south
like you're not allowed to be an individual in that space. You have to be seen in relation to the community that you exist in. And so unfortunately we're not allowed to actually see our own individual pleasures, desires that are somewhat antithetical to the needs of everybody else. Do you understand what I'm saying? And how a lot of that is very individualized. And I think that's why I'm moving away from this idea of seeing a community and seeing it more as a collective of identities, right? It's like we all exist very differently in this space. We all have very different thoughts, different beliefs, different pleasures, different desires, and it's important that we recognize how those desires differ, because it then allows us to hold each other accountable when your desire is antithetical to my existence, right? So ideas of, you know, some people's idea of liberation is very trans exclusive, right? But yet they are still part of the queer community, quote unquote. And it's like actually us understanding that while we share an identity and we can be a collective on the terms of that, of that kind of neutrality, we're not all in community with each other.
Yeah.
Do you get me? And
we should have been let in the door.
And it's like, and it's not always even because your pleasure and your desire is different from mine means it's necessarily antithetical to my existence. You know, some people's desires are just, it's again, like you said, like traveling abroad, for example, if that's your desire, it doesn't necessarily harm queer people any in around the world. It's, but again, it's about presenting that as community freedom. Win.
Yeah.
Like we have now won as a community. It's like
because
you traveled, and it's like, wow. And do you understand, like it's yeah.
I think we should think about that for a minute.
I'm screaming.
But since we've established that, I want us to paint a future, right? What do we envision for queer storytelling in Nigeria and Africa at large? Kayode, or anybody. Kayode, do you want to talk about?
My vision for the future of queer literature is a body of work that kind of really encapsulates all the riches of our experiences, the pain, the joy, the disappointment, the whole spectrum of, you know, wins and losses, and also a literature that is able to hold a mirror up to Nigerian society, a literature that doesn't seek to normalize queer people or doesn't seek to assimilate queer people into the, you know, rest of society. You know, I'm so bored by the "we are just like you" type of narratives.
I mean, let's denormalize things.
Yeah,
the whole
right, because I really look forward to a literature that, you know, is content in describing queer people as not like the rest of Nigerian society, not like cisgender and heterosexual people, a literature that doesn't conceptualize queer liberation as equality with, you know, cisgender people who are currently oppressed based on class and even based on like the brutal imperialist domination that we are going through right now. And so it's a literature that goes beyond what we currently have, even for, you know, people that are cisgender and heterosexual, and defines itself based on what it thinks that queer people need. So the way it's going to define our happiness, the way we define our pain, the way we define our aspirations, our goals, should all be something that centers what our needs are and not what we think that cisgender people have that we want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like what I have in mind.
What worked for you can work for us. Yeah, Adebayo.
Kaede basically said, go and read, and then he sung a lullaby. Buy my book. And then I want this, which is in my book. And then I want this, which is in my book. I want this, which is also in my book.
I have the recommendation in my book. Yeah, you all should better buy that.
Actually, you could already pre-order it. Regardless of where you are.
Okay.
So you could, if you wanted to pre-order the book, for people in Germany, I think that's the US. So you could order it from basically everywhere.
The US or UK?
No,
the UK is closer.
No,
that's not how it works.
That's not how it works. So for the UK is UK and Commonwealth, except Canada and Africa. And then US is US and rest of the world, except Africa. So
thank you for the education.
So you could order it on Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, you know, bookseller, basically anywhere that you normally get your books.
So you're letting Jeff Bezos sell your books. Yeah, I think all of what Kaede said, I absolutely agree with. But I think I, just to present, I guess, my own thoughts that sits beside that. So I don't think it sits in opposition. But I think a space where queer literature can exist, not, and again, goes back to this new, well, forming understanding of queerness that doesn't have to sit in resistance to anything, because I think there's a lot of richness that queer people can produce. That doesn't always have to center an opposition to something. And I think it goes back to
even have a message at all. It could just be, or even have a message. It could just be literature that enjoys language.
Yeah.
Enjoys.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it goes back to what you said about, even at the end of your statement, about the fact that, you know, it's not about wanting what straight people have. And I think, just to even push that a little bit further, it's also not about not wanting what straight people have. So it's not about saying, oh, I want what straight people have, and then kind of swing it up, and then in the opposite direction saying, oh, it's about me rejecting what straight people have. Keep straight people aside, keep rich people aside, keep all of these things aside, and tell a story that kind of centers you, your creativity. And I think a lot of these are not devoid of politics, they're not devoid of accountability, they're not devoid of critique. They still exist within our current milieu and our current systems of, our current systems. So it's not devoid of all of these things, but it's just saying that queer people should be able to create just for the sake of creating in ways that aren't always in resistance to something, mm-hmm. that always standing in opposition to something, or always wanting to be anti-normative. Because again, all the time, I think the yardstick for normativity shifts all the time. So what are we really defining as queer if we're always constantly being against the norm, you know? And I think that's what's very important for us to be understanding, even with creatives and queer people that create, especially existing in a world where, particularly by like Western consumers, our work is very politicized. It's very commercialized. Like, the politicization of our work is a part of the commercial. We should be able to like opt out of that and not necessarily want it to, I mean, not to say it wouldn't be political or commercial, but again, it's something that starts with our own creativity and our own ways of
You mean not having
ourselves.
That in mind as, you know, what is driving our creation of that work?
Yeah, so it's like, I'm not creating this work for it to be commercial. I'm not creating this work for it to be politicized. Not to say it wouldn't be.
Yeah, but that's not.
But it's like, that's not where you're starting from. Yeah, and I think that sits within that understanding of queerness that isn't just, I'm fighting you. I'm against you. Do you understand? Like, it's just like, I think it's really a centering of joy. It's a centering of pleasure. And again, a lot of these things are very ambivalent. I don't see joy as this massively good thing or pleasure as this. Again, like, these things hold very ambivalent positions in the sense that they're not always inherently good or inherently bad. Not everything that brings you joy is a good thing. Not everything that brings you pleasure is a good thing. So we can still critique these things. We can still critique your work. But again, it's still good because it's ambivalent because it comes from a place of creativity and a place of, it starts from you as a person and it gets to know you, who you are. Again, as an individual within the collective who doesn't have to be part of this one community with one thought and one process and one way of being. Because if we as a queer community say we want to be one community with one thought, one way of being, one way of doing, one way of acting, what makes us any different from the quote unquote norm that we're trying to deviate from, you know?
Before we go, I'd love each of you to recommend three to five Nigerian / African novels to our viewers so they could check it out and read up and decolonize your mind.
Okay, I think I recommend And Then He Sang Me a Lullaby
by
Kayode Somtuchukwuanyi. But also She Called Me Woman, published by Kasara Republic. Also I think together we can come up with these together.
I just have
to the joint work.
Yeah.
Working with Shadows by Jude Dibia. So that's like obvious. And then The Death of Vivek Oje. I think everybody should definitely read that book by Akweke. Like, Akweke, they just finished work on that like they finished they ate the whole plate, they ate the table, they ate the room, they ate the building. And the left, no crumbs. So that's the second one.
And do you want to say more?
No, I'm done.
I have more. Oh, first of all, like, yes, Death of Vivek Oje. Please go read it. Beautiful book.
And I wanted to just add Under the Odala Trees by
Yes.
And Happiness, like, I love Happiness Like Water. No, I love
God's Children. Also, God's Children, like A Little Broken Things.
By Arinze, if you
can do. That's also but also, and I think also books that aren't necessarily by queer authors or explicitly queer, but can help you understand queerness. I always have to do this. I'm sorry. It just doesn't sit right with me. Go on, say it.
Oyewumi.
The Invention of Women. And also What Gender Is Motherhood. I think all of these books will kind of help you reconceptualize.
I think Ifeanyi Amadiume as well.
Ifeanyi Amadiume is Male Daughters, Female Husbands. Yeah. Absolutely. That would give you like an Igbo perspective. Like, these are very, very important books in really understanding. And I know, like, some of these authors, they probably will not call themselves queer theorists or like, but it sits nicely in queer theory, I think.
I mean, Ifeanyi Amadiume's work is like,
it's groundbreaking.
Absolutely. That is to say the least.
Absolutely.
Groundbreaking.
But again, if you ask them, like, oh, is it queer?
Yeah, because that wasn't, you know.
It wasn't the intention. Yeah, wasn't which intention. I actually kind of low-key agree with, because it's like, for them, it wasn't about adding to this body.
I mean,
it's just
about African society, period.
Exactly. And I think that's, even goes back to what I was saying as well. Like, it doesn't sit in opposition to anything. So that's nice.
Yeah, thank you both for coming to my podcast today. And thank you to my listeners for joining us. Watch out for the next episode. And thank you all once more.
Podcast Burkhülshoff Center for Literature.
Queer Circles is a joint project between Matthew Blaise, Miriam Bettin, and Burkhülshoff Center for Literature, in cooperation with Goethe-Institut Nigeria. Funded by the Bundesstiftung Magnus Hirschfeld and by Fonds Soziokultur within the program Neustart Kultur on behalf of the Beauftragte der Bundesregierung für Kultur und Medien.